Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if we start to come. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we watch X Squared Radio. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your Never-Ending Life is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrew. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrew at X Squared Radio and order the book today. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, just returned a few hours ago from Tibet, 19 days. What an adventure. In here, the results are always positive. Tonight, the solar wind is a very mild 375.6 kilometers per second. There are no sunspots. Very mild coronal hole. In short, all is quiet from the sun. Recent studies seem to indicate that our powerful cell phone networks may be killing the honeybees. You might not think that is so bad of a trade-off, but if true, it could mean a significant drop in agriculture production. Bees pollinate the plants. Without the bees, we have no fruit to harvest. The blooms sit there unfertilized until they drop off. No bees, no food. Just something to think about, people. Last week, we ran an archive of Maureen St. Germain's interview here on X Squared Radio. And the week before that, we ran the archive with David Sarita. That was a great program. Next week on X Squared Radio, we'll have several speakers who will be appearing at the upcoming Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference in Hawaii on the program, including Dr. Michael Sala and Angelica Whitecliff. I will be speaking at this convention, which goes from May 10th through the 13th. Excuse me. So if you are planning a trip to Hawaii during that time, or if you live in the islands, make sure to make your way to that conference. I guarantee you will learn something important. Our second hour tonight, we have Dr. Richard Bartlett, who developed a revolutionary new technique, Master Energy Dynamics, which used functional principles of biochemistry, physiology, and anatomy to affect real-time changes in people's stress responses. He found that chronic disease is a product of a lifelong maladaptation to physiological, biochemical, and emotional stressors. In our third hour, we will have Maureen St. Germain with us. As I said, we just returned from 19 days in Tibet, Kathmandu, and learned a lot. And we're going to try to give you as much as we can in the last 60 minutes of our program. And we will open the phone lines beginning the first hour, because tonight we have with us an extremely special guest, Don Miguel Ruiz. Raised in rural Mexico by a curandera, healer, mother, and a Nahual shaman grandfather, his family wanted him to follow in their footsteps, but distracted by modern life, Miguel chose to attend medical school to become a surgeon. However, a near-death experience changed him. We only have an hour with him, so I don't want to take all night talking about this, his many accomplishments, but he is the author of The Four Agreements, which was on the New York Times bestsellers list for 6 years and sold more than 3 million copies. He also wrote The Mastery of Love, Prayers, and The Voice of Knowledge, as well as a companion book for The Four Agreements. More in the works. Please welcome with me Don Miguel Ruiz. Thank you so much for being on the program tonight.
Well, thank you very much for this invitation. It's an honor for me to be in your program.
Oh, I can assure you that the honor is all mine. I have long been a fan of your book. The Four Agreements is a staple in our office. We hand it around and read it quite a bit just to keep ourselves abreast with it. And your publicist, Joyce, was so kind to send me copies of The Mastery of Love, Prayers, and the companion book to The Four Agreements, and I've read those, and they're just as fantastic as the first book.
Well, I've been just very, very lucky, you know, since my whole life. I grew up in a world where everything is possible. And I never really have all those limitations. I always see my life with the point of view of an artist, and I always want to have this curiosity to learn more and give more and change it more as possible.
Well, I know you have to be a very curious and inquisitive and brilliant person to become a surgeon, especially coming from a rural area where you know, may not have a lot of inspirational people around to as mentors. But yes, luck is some of it, but it's also a tremendous amount of hard work. I want to know about the experience that inspired you to add to your accomplishments as a surgeon with the writings that you have graced us with. How did you come to that?
Well, we can say that this is really a whole mastery. We call it the mastery of awareness. And it's about practice awareness. Practice and practice, you know, practice makes the master. Until the point that your awareness is that big that you can almost understand everything. And the challenge really is to simplify what you perceive in order to share it in a way that everybody can understand it. That becomes extremely simple, because we really complicate everything. It's not that that life is so complicated. We make it complicated. You know, we try to understand the meaning of everything. And by trying to explain those meanings, we really complicate the entire life. And we create a universe that really becomes very complicated.
Well, I agree with you. I think we do make our lives maybe far too complicated. But by the same token, we sort of glaze over the more simple pleasures in life. We forget how to be like little children, how to just have fun.
Yes, and we can say that the simplest way is just to be yourself, because you don't need to try to be anybody else. You are what you are. And from that point, everything becomes extremely easy.
Well, what is it, do you think, that makes people forget their dream when they're little kids and they dream about what they want to be when they grow up? They see something on TV, or they have a relative or a hero that they want to emulate, maybe a great baseball player or a doctor or an astronaut. What makes a child forget his dream?
Well, you know, we really learn everything that we perceive. Not exactly what people say, but we learn what people do. Then when we grow up in a family where the parents are always fighting, or there's all those kind of dramas, and in our neighborhood is all that drama existing, we try to be like them. And that's what we learn, to be the way they are, to speak the way they speak, and it's not necessarily what they tell us to learn. We learn what they do.
Huh.
Becomes a copy of people around us, and we try to be like them. We try to be like mom, like dad, like the old brother, like uncle, like whoever we see on the television, with all the heroes that exist in our mind. We try to imitate everybody.
Well, don't they, too, as grown-ups, don't they try to sort of hook your attention, try to pull you in and make you part of their game?
You know, life is all those events that are happening all the time at the same time, and all the events try to hook your attention. Then the events that hook your attention is the ones who's going to guide you in your life. Then in all those events could be a strong father, could be a strong uncle, could be, a doctor, could be someone who put you in, and you try to be like them.
Well, I understand, having a role model, somebody to follow, somebody to go after, but isn't there, more to it than that? Isn't, you say in your book that what we call education is nothing but domestication of the human being.
Yes, it's just like a domesticated dog or the cat, and it's made by the people who love us the most. And that's the reason why we pretend to be what we are not. We forget what we really are because we are so afraid to the punishment. But most of that is, I think, we are more afraid not to get the reward.
Oh, so it's not so much a fear of being punished. It's a feeling that you're not going to get the reward if you don't perform.
Well, yes, because the biggest reward that we can have is the attention of the people around us. You see the child, 6, 7 years old, jumping and saying, look at me, father, mother, look at me, look what I'm doing, look what I'm doing. If we don't have any witness, we don't have any attention, then we don't have that reward. And we don't have to pretend either anyway.
So it's very important if your kids are out there saying, look at me, watch me do this, dad. It's important to be there watching.
Yes, they're competing for our attention. And in a certain point in our life, we find out how important is attention. Because even when we grow up, we want the attention of people that we consider more powerful than us. We want to be noticed in what we are doing. And in the radio, the television, and in any activity in life, we really try to get attention, and if we can get attention to many people, it's even stronger and more powerful. They call it power.
I see. So if we jump forward from talking about kids and parents, let's talk about, like you say in your book, The Mastery of Love, let's talk about husbands and wives, how they interact with one another. What is a wounded mind?
Well, we can say that it is a war of competition, a war of power in between a couple. Usually it's that way, not always. And it's to see who can impose to the other a point of view, a way of life. When the truth is something much more simple than that, because if we really see everything the way it is, we will find out that we live in our life, in our dream, and really nobody else is living in that dream. Everybody else lives in their own dream. There's something that it takes some time for us to find out, but when we find out that, life becomes much more easier. Because you can get peace when finally you learn to respect your own dream, your own point of view. Once that you get that peace because you respect yourself, you make peace also with the rest of the world by respecting the rest of the world, everybody else, to respect the way they believe, the way they think, the way they are. Because only they can live their life. Nobody can live their life. As nobody can live your life. You are the only one who can live your life. It doesn't matter if your wife or your mother or your son want to live your life, they cannot do that. You are the only one who really can live your life. But if we respect also their life, then we will find out that it's so easy to live in peace.
Well, sometimes life, or at least relationships, don't have peace. I mean, if everything was, peace and happiness, joy and tranquility, we wouldn't have a need for, great teachers like Don Miguel. But your books sell because there are a lot of people out there that are in emotional pain because something went wrong, either with them or with their relationship, and the alarm system for the emotional body, you say, is fear. So how much does fear play a part in these kinds of relationships?
Well, fear is a very important part in this kind of relationship. When we grow up, we hardly can wait to be big enough to live the drama that the other people live. We even see the dramas on the soap operas and television, in relatives that are older than us. And we hardly can wait to grow up to live those dramas and to play the way they play. Like I was telling you a little before, to be a copy of them. It looks like fun, but when we finally grow up and we are in the middle of a relationship, it's no longer that fun. We want to be right and make everybody else wrong. We want to impose our opinion. We want to control other people's lives. And we create all that drama, and really we are the one who create our own drama. If we recognize that, we can change it. We create our own dream. We are the artist, and only we can change it. Nobody really can change it for us.
So how do you change from the track of fear to a track of love?
Well, the first step is always to be aware, to notice that this is what is happening, and to accept it. And that's to try to change it, to practice awareness all the time. Awareness is something that we need to practice all the time that we are awake, and also if we can when the brain is sleeping. But awareness in the practice is what really makes the whole mastery. And that's what really makes life so easy. If we are aware of what we are doing, we will not do it anymore if what we are doing is against us. But if what we're doing is helping us, we will do it even more often and more stronger.
Yeah.
And that's the way that how we can change our own life and make it much better. You know, we don't need to play with blame, with guilt, with shame, with fear, with hate. When we know that all those dramas really create big chaos in our life. And there is not a reason why to have any enemy in the whole world.
Well, who should we concentrate on if we're trying to move from this, if we're trying to raise awareness in our relationship, in our lives, and we want to shift from fear to love, who should we concentrate on?
Well, first we have to find what makes the difference. And be aware that is what is making the difference. And what is making the difference is something that we call respect. If we don't have respect, we will not have peace. And respect always begins with ourselves. We need to respect our own life, our own point of view, and recognize that only we can live our life and nobody else. At the same time, we respect the life of our wife, the life of our children, the life of our parents or friends, and we always want to be good with everybody. Then this is the key of the good relationship, is respect. When we don't have that respect, we lose the love little by little. And drama keep growing and growing, and blame and shame and even violence can be part of that drama. But respect is the key.
And that drama is a bad thing. We don't want to have drama in a relationship. We don't want to have fear in the relationship. And really, I guess what you're saying is if we can heal relationships between people one by one or two by two, before too long, we heal the planet.
And this is what is happening already. You know, the planet is changing very fast. You know, there's only 7 years in this century. But if we see the last century, the first half was a little slow and the second half was very fast. But if we go a little further, a century before, the world was very slow. And before that, for thousands of years, it was very, very slow. Now let's see the last 10 years of the last century. It was extremely fast. Computers and the way we technology, science, became so fast and so strong. But psychology is still the same. And that's what needs to be changed now. We have to catch up with technology. We have to catch up with science. Because it's going very fast and we need to change as fast as technology.
Do you
Even
think
we see our children, 10, 15 years old, playing with computers, we can do it, see them do so many things that it was looking impossible for us in our time when we were children.
When you say that the world is changing very rapidly, I think anybody can see that the technology certainly is changing at an amazing rate. I think even scholars say that we're doubling our technology now every 4 years.
Yes, everything is changing, but psychology.
Yeah.
We still believe in Freud.
Right. We still believe in Freud.
And so many superstitions that exist right there. Then with awareness, we end all this, the superstitions. Then we don't have to believe anymore.
Yeah, I think if we, from what I gather from what you've written and people that I've spoken to that have read your books, they learn that love is unconditional and fear is full of conditions.
Yes, and that's what creates the whole drama. I love you if. I love if you put attention on me. I love if you take care of me. I love if you dress the way I want you to dress. I love you. Just speak the way I want you to speak. If you behave the way I want you, that's how can I love you? Yeah.
But what if they don't? I mean, what if the person, as you say in your book, buys a dog, but they like cats, so they keep trying to teach the dog to say meow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are they doing with a dog? Why don't they get a cat?
Well, what they need to do is to let go of the dog and get the cat. To be honest with themselves. To respect what they really want. And, you know, if you don't want a dog but you love a cat, that dog will be miserable with you. Then it will be something great if you let go of that dog, that the Lord can find someone who loves dogs. And you get the cat that you really want.
So you say, find a person who matches with you.
Yes.
Take the risk, but be honest.
Well, the one that you really want to be with, and not just to be with that person because you're afraid.
Hmm.
Afraid to be alone, afraid of poverty, afraid of whatever. There's many kinds of fear.
Well,
we tolerate so many things because of fear.
So are you saying that many relationships may last a lot longer than they should because of this fear?
Yes.
And maybe you're saying if it doesn't work, then do yourself and your partner a favor. Just walk away.
Yes, let your partner alone, that your partner can get somebody to make her or make him happy. And give yourself that favor also. But next time, just be aware. If you begin a new relationship, be aware that this is what you want.
Hmm. So I guess in a nutshell, you're saying that one person cannot bring another person happiness.
No, only you can make yourself happy. And you make yourself happy by giving to yourself all what you really wanted to. And that includes a couple.
So then likewise, if you're sad or angry or frustrated or unfulfilled, you're responsible for that too.
Yes, you are. Even if it's a result of somebody else's dream.
Hmm. Wow, I really like that.
That makes life so easy.
Yeah, it does. It sounds easy, but it's, you know, a lot of people that I know, it doesn't work that way. They often see the forces at work in their lives that are making them miserable or happy are outside of their lives. They think that they have received you know, great wealth because of life's lottery and through no work of their own, or they feel like, you know, the misery that they have in their relationship is just what they were handed and they have to live with it.
And it's not true at all. Then awareness is a very important key.
And really the awareness is a self-awareness, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it's just the only point of view that we have. Because we human only have one point of view.
Well, I hear a lot of points of view from a lot of people. And they're not mine.
Yes, and you understand their point of view. But all that information going to your into your ear, going to your brain, and the reaction is your reaction according to your point of view. Then after you digest everything that you hear, you make it yours.
Yeah, well,
your
opinion
is what you believe.
I personally think that I'm a fairly aware person, and I can tell when somebody's pushing my buttons, you know, reacting to what I'm saying or trying to get me to react to what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm aware of what's going on, so I don't really let myself fall into fear or defense or try to be aggressive.
Personally.
Yeah, and I the thing I really like about your books is they're easy to read. They're not thousands of pages. They're a couple hundred pages. You can read them in a couple of days without really pushing yourself hard. And the points that these books make are so clear and so simple, they're understandable by anyone.
That was exactly the challenge that I had when I write these books, to make books that is direct to everyone who can read it. It doesn't matter how intelligent or not is the person who is reading it. It's so direct for everyone. And to make it that simple that anyone can understand it, that's a big challenge.
Well, it's simple enough even I can understand it, and that's good. I have given away copies of these books, and I will continue to buy them and give them away as gifts, because it has such great simple points to it, and I encourage people to buy the books and to underline things in them and go back to them over and over again, because there's great learning here. He has in this book called The Mastery of Love, which the title is exactly what the book means. He says, if we look for a partner, it is because we want to play. We want to be happy and enjoy what we are. We don't choose a partner just to give that person we claim to love all our garbage, to put all our jealousy, all our anger, all our selfishness onto that person. And that's exactly right. But I go just down the street just a little bit, and I can see that very thing going on. Somebody is piling all their anger upon their partner.
And the partner is accepting it. You know, we can say that people only can abuse us till the point that we abuse ourselves. Nobody can abuse us more than the way we abuse ourselves. This is our limit. And of course, everybody has a different limit. Can somebody treat you a little better than the way you treat yourself, or should you stay the rest of your life with that person?
Oh, yeah.
But if someone just abuses you a little more than what you abuse yourself, it's time to go.
Yeah.
This is exactly your limit.
Tell us about the magical kitchen.
Oh, this is a beautiful story. You know, and this is based in the people who are so starving for love. People who don't feel any love, and that they're so needy for love that they're searching and searching all around the world for love. And what I told them is, well, your heart is just like a magical kitchen. And that magical kitchen can create so much love, not just for yourself, but for the rest of the world. And you don't even need to make any effort, really. Because you are love. Anyway, let's imagine that someone coming to your door, knock at your door, and bring a pizza. And they say, well, you see what I bring for you? I bring this pizza for you. And you can have it if you let me control your life. Obviously, your reaction, you will laugh and say, oh, well, no, thank you. I have a magical kitchen. And I create all the pizzas I want to. I can create any kind of food I want to. And I have abundance in my home. I can even give to the whole world if I want to. And I don't need to charge anything for that. And this is without conditions. But what happened is this thing, like with the pizza, go with us to another home. And it's a home that someone who is so needy for love, who feels that nobody loves her or loves him, that nobody cares about him, and knock at the door and say, see what I bring for you? It's pizza. And this year, if you just let me control your life, the person will say right away, oh, why, yes, I'm so starving. And eat the whole pizza right away. Then you say, well, if tomorrow you need more pizza, I can bring you more. And if the relationship becomes very similar to the drug addict and someone who provides drugs, then the drug addict is so needy. that wants everything and can be abused by the other person. Becomes a kind of a slave for this other person. But when you have your magical kitchen, nobody in the whole world will control you in the name of love. No one.
What is the magical kitchen? Where is it?
Well, it's your love. It's your heart. It's the real you. You know, we represent a symbol that we call love. The problem is that symbol is being so distorted that when people believe they are in love, they are really being possessed by that symbol.
Wow.
But we are not a symbol, we are the real thing. But we call it love. And when we believe in that love, we are really asking for problems. It's like a demon that is possessing people. Then you can see jealousy, you can see anger, you can see hate, you can see all the symptoms. Just imagine that movie, The Exorcist, and see the little girl who is possessed by the devil. I tell the people, when you're so angry, you see yourself in a mirror, you will see this little girl. You're being possessed by your anger. You're being possessed by your jealousy. You're being possessed by that symbol that we call love, because this is fake love. It's not real love. Real love is unconditional. Real love makes you happy to make everybody else happy. Real love is generous and is grateful. And it's taking you to happiness, to joy.
Well, in this travel to discover unconditional love in ourselves and to get it from somebody else, this mastery of awareness, this transformation to kind of break free of the old dream to create a new dream where all this is possible. You say that the Toltecs used to divide people into two types, dreamers and stalkers. Help us understand that concept a little bit.
Well, we can say that the stalker is really a dreamer who is not aware that he's living in a dream, but he sees his life like an action or reaction. It's hard for that person to really believe that we're living in a dream. But with that action-reaction, he can have complete control over his own life. Then the stalker is that person that is so realistic. You know, everything for that person is real. And this is not good or bad or right or wrong. It's just the way it is.
Huh. So there's kind of a self-judgment going on there.
Yes.
Well, that beep tells us we have a caller on the line. Caller, can you give us your first name and where you're calling from?
Yeah, hi, this is Ludmilla, and I'm calling from Montreal.
All right, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Do you have a question for Don Miguel?
No, I want just to listen to it.
Well, you can listen by going to bbsradio.com. And choosing your favorite player and listening to it on your computer.
I was trying to do so, but I was not successful.
I understand. And I apologize for that. But we try to make the technology as easy as we can, but we try to keep the phone lines open so people can call in and ask the guest a question. So we'll try to work with the producer and see if we can't get you connected. So getting back to this self-awareness and this way of, stalking or dreaming, whether we're going to create or whether we're going to chase after somebody else and, like a jaguar, you stalk every action and reaction. how do we break free of that habit? A lot of people have this habit that they just, it's like they are born to fight, and they just don't know how to just have peace with one another.
Well, this is extremely easy once we are aware why are we fighting for. Then we will find out that the real fight that we have is for our authenticity, for ourselves. You know, one of the greatest things that my grandfather told me is, Miguel, you know that you're free when you no longer have to be yourself. You know, the stalkers is always seeking itself. Until finally it will find out that there's nothing you can do. It's him. It's always been him. He was just pretending to be something else.
Well, yeah, I see that. But I see people that they sort of have a rebellion going on inside of them. What they call happiness is a rebellion against their own emotional pain. And you say in your book, in that happiness, they are so hurt that they actually have fun hurting other people and hurting themselves.
Yes, that wounds are being driven by something that we call injustice. And it's a reaction for an event that happened, whatever is that event. Then we consider it as an injustice, and it's cut an emotional wound into our emotional body, and your reaction is emotional pain that looks like anger, like sadness, impotence. You know, there's many words that we can use to try to understand that emotional reaction, but it's nothing but emotional poison that is hurting, and it's very, very contagious. Then in our reaction, we try to send that emotional poison to the other person to try to get even. And the result of that is like a playing ping pong with emotional poison to see who is the strongest one.
Just yeah. Sending it back and forth, back and forth.
Yes. You know, it's like, for example, that wife that in the morning just finds something out. And all the morning is building more and more emotional poison, and making so many assumptions, taking so many things so personally. And the husband is very happy at work. And when finally he comes back home, he finds that face waiting for him. And since the very beginning, he starts trying and trying and trying to hurt it. He knows that something is wrong, he tries to escape. But she keeps trying and trying until finally she makes him react. When he reacts, then she feels that all the poison is released. Now it's on him. Now he is the one who is angry. He's the one, and maybe he don't even know why. Then he has to do something to let go all those emotions. And now he is going after her. And this is time that she wants to kind of run away sometimes or face a whole fight if it's necessary. And that keeps growing and growing and growing, and for sure they don't even know the reason why. And when the truth finally arrives, everybody could say or do things that they will not forgive.
So why do you think that people have to get even this way? Why, when he walks in, does she have to, you know, keep going and going and going until she gets her poison inside of him? And by the way, when he reacts and comes back, he not only has her poison inside of him, he has his poison.
His home, yeah. And the reason is because they grew up in that way. That's what they learned from their parents, from relatives, from everybody around them. That was, there was weakness that they were doing all the time.
And so awareness is the way out of this.
Yes. When you're aware, definitely is a way out. You know, it's like many people come and ask me, well, why don't you teach children? And I told them, well, I don't teach children because they have parents. Whatever I share with the children will be undone by the parents. Then I prefer to work with the parents. And then the parents change, and they are the ones who's going to change the way they teach the children. And the way they change is by its own awareness, that they break all that chain that carry for the family. Then they will not treat their children as the parents treat them, or the grandfather treats the parents. Then it's a brand new way. And this is people's awareness.
Wow. Now, in your book, The Four Agreements, I know a tremendous... Excuse me, I've been at high altitude for the last 19 days. My lungs are a little tender. I know you thought long and hard about what the four agreements would be. Can you just tell our listening audience what the four agreements are and why you came up with these particular four?
Okay, well, the very first one is be impeccable with the world. And this is based in you use your words to create the story of your life. Everything about you. And your story is always changing. Then your word is changing everything. Then to be impeccable with the word is means that you're never going to use the word against yourself. Never. Under any circumstance.
I got you.
That if you write your own story, you're always going to create a great story about yourself. And it's not that the story is truth or not truth, because the story is just telling something that it supposedly happened to you or not. But anyway, to be impeccable with the word, this is like to say to be impeccable with the pen or to be impeccable with the pencil if you're an artist.
Sure, why would you...
That they will follow what you want to create. It's your creation. You use the word to create everything. In another word, you are your word. Then the second one is don't take anything personally. Because we can say that everybody living their own dream, as you live in your own dream, then whatever they say about you in their dream has nothing to do with you really. Then to not to take anything personally, that gives you immunity in the relationship that you have with everybody else. If you don't take anything personally, you have so much advantage the way you deal with society.
Well, what happens if you don't take things personal, but your partner does? In other words, you have come to this awareness, but in the process, your partner doesn't agree with that awareness or refuses to understand. How does one move forward here?
Well, first of all, you don't take it personally. Then whatever she or he is going to say or do is just her point of view, really has nothing to do with you. And you know that. You know, your mother can swear to God that she knows you very well. But is that true that she knows you? I don't think so. And you can swear that you know your children very well. But the truth is that I don't think you know them.
Well, that's true. And
then if they don't know you, how can you can take personally whatever they say about you?
Yeah.
How can you take personally the judgments or punishment or whatever they want to? No, that gives you immunity, and that's the greatest part of that agreement. It's like the third agreement, don't make assumptions. That agreement is going to give you immunity in the relationship that you have with yourself. Because you deal with yourself a lot. You know, we have that voice of knowledge in our head that we call thinking. that is always talking and talking and talking and talking. But not because he's talking all the time, it means that he's truthful. It doesn't mean he's saying the truth. And that voice makes us make a lot of assumptions. Then if we don't make assumptions, we don't have that conflict with ourselves. And we really learn to respect ourselves.
I got you.
And the fourth one is really the action. Always do your best. Perhaps it's difficult to be impeccable with the word. Perhaps it's difficult not to take this personally or not make assumptions. But there's something that you can do, and always is to do your best. No more and no less. Just your best. You will find out that your best is getting better and better and better, because your best is the practice, and practice makes the master.
That's right. Practice makes the master. Mm-hmm. I was talking to my 15-year-old son the other day, who brought home less than what he's capable of for a midterm grade. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, you know, that's not as well as you have been doing. I just have one question. Did you do your best? And he said, well, no. I said, well, then are you surprised that you didn't get the grade that you are normally used to? I suggest that you do your best, always, no matter what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So that's great. And if a person's best is C for now, that's okay. But as you say, over time, he'll master it, and the C will become a B, and the B will become an A, because his best will get better and better, because he competes with himself.
Then when we finally learn to do our best all the time, we will find something very interesting.
Yeah.
And that is guiding you to something that we call forgiveness. When you see your own life and you see your parents educating you, you find out that they really was doing their best, the best they could at that time.
Yeah.
And from that moment that you have that awareness, they are no longer guilty for whatever you thought they were guilty. And when you know, oh, they just did their best, forgiveness comes right away. And with that forgiveness, you heal all the emotional poison that you have in you. Then your relationship with your parents, with many other people, it will change almost right away.
And if we could change that, then we might be able to change the behavior and the attitudes in our neighborhood, and then in our neighborhood, our city, and our city, our state, and so forth.
It is happening.
Well, that beat means we have a telephone call, and we're right at almost at the top of the hour, so we'll have to make it pretty quick. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from?
Yeah, this is Ken from Indiana.
Hi, Ken.
Hello, Brooke.
I know Ken. And now you know Don Miguel Ruiz. This is Ken, my friend.
Hi, Ken.
Blessings to you, Don Miguel. I want to tell you deeply from my heart how much your books have helped transform my life. I love you.
Oh, I love you too. Thank you very much.
My wife, Angela, is
give her all my love.
So inspired by your works.
Yeah,
and,
give her all my love.
We read your books all the time. And I think we might have lost the caller. Don, are you still there? Hi, Don, you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, we're right at the top of the hour, and I apologize. I could easily do 3 hours with you, and I'd love to have you back on the program again. But we are out of time for this hour, and I have another guest coming on next hour. And we'll continue reading your books and giving them away as gifts. I thank you so much for being on the program and for who you are and what you're doing.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thank you for having me on your program.
It's my pleasure.
Okay, all my love for all of you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, my friends, we will be heading for a break right now. We will be back after these messages, and we'll have Dr. Richard Bartlett on the program. You don't want to miss this segment. Again, this is X Squared Radio with Brooks Agnew, where the past meets the future. We'll be back. Welcome back to X Squared Radio, our second hour tonight. By the way, this is a three-hour program, so if your affiliate is only playing 1 or 2 hours of this program, make sure to get a hold of us, give us their call letters, and we'll take care of the rest. Tonight, our second hour, we have Dr. Richard Bartlett with us. He developed a revolutionary new technique called Master Energy Dynamics, which uses functional principles of biochemistry, physiology, and anatomy to affect real-time changes in people's stress responses. He found that chronic disease is a product of a lifelong maladaptation to physiological, biochemical, and emotional stressors. It is our pleasure to have Dr. Richard Bartlett on our program. Welcome to X Squared Radio.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. I hate to start out by correcting something, but the press materials that apparently everybody has, including Contact Radio, I was on this week earlier, talks about Master Energy Dynamics, which I developed in the early 90s, and what I'm teaching now is Matrix Energetics. Sounds similar, but is completely different. Basically, is a field-based effect that works with intent, so it's much simpler to learn. Not something, Master Energy Dynamics, not something I want to inflict on anybody at this point.
Well, tell us a little bit about the Matrix. How does that work?
Well, in 1997, early 1997, I was attending naturopathy school in Seattle, Bastyr University, and I was also working as a chiropractor, so I was taking 31 credit hours, which is a lot.
That is a lot.
It's an altered state, basically. It's course
in altered 22 state. In chemistry, and I thought I was going to go crazy. 31 is incredible.
Yeah, 31 is not good. But that is standard for most medical schools. That does not include labs or any of the time you spend as a clinician. So it's more than that. But anyway, I was driving back and forth from Seattle to Livingston, Montana, which is about a 13-hour drive one way. And then I was working as a chiropractor on the weekends twice a month in order to pay the bills. So that's kind of like one of these advanced courses in out-of-body states. Well, one of the times that when I got to Livingston, I was very tired, as you might imagine. I worked all day, and at the end of the day, I had this woman bring her little girl in to see me, and the little girl had a lazy eye. Just one of the eyes doesn't keep up, and so it drifts a little bit, and it creates all sorts of problems, can create headaches and visual disturbances and problems with balance and so on. She'd been to the neurologist already, and there was nothing they could do. Well, the long and short of it is I had this very bizarre experience where I saw what looked like George Reeves as Superman. And this can tell you how tired you can get and what can happen. You don't need drugs, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Three-dimensional hologram, full color. This beam of energy appeared to go out of his eyes into the little girl that I was working on, and I saw this blockage there. And I have to tell you, I learned at an early age in my chiropractic training that little children, if you stick your finger in their mouth, they will bite. So I wasn't going to stick my finger in her mouth because there's some cranial techniques that might have helped, but I remember what that feels like. So I went with the big guy in the red and blue, and I just touched the area where I saw the blockage, and something happened, and it dissolved. The little girl started blinking at me, and her lazy eye was, we use the word, quote, healed, which in fact it was. It never was a problem ever again. But that was the beginning of what is now known as matrix energetics, so not exactly that other thing you were talking about, thank God.
What do you think happened there when you touched the little girl? You had an intention that you transferred from you to her. What do you think happened?
Well, you know, I think that Superman, for me, because I grew up watching George Reeves, is an archetype for X-ray vision and for superhuman states. And I believe probably what was happening is call it an aspect of my higher self was coming through. Perhaps it was programmed, it was time. These things happen in cycles. And when I saw this, I just went with what I saw. I've had other things happen in my clinical training that I trusted that worked out all right. So I decided I would trust, which is always a good idea with something like this, as long as it appears to be safe. And I'm not sure what exactly occurred, and in fact it took me 4 years after that event, more or less, to begin to develop a philosophy and an understanding of the energy that was present from that moment on.
So it wasn't just that one time event.
Not at all.
You had a lot more data.
No, that basically was the opening salvo in a very intense period. About a month later, on my birthday, I don't remember what birthday it was, it's been too long, but I got a further download of information, and this looked more like, what it looked like was a master, standing in the road. I was driving my daughter home up the mountain and coming back in my third eye, if you want to say that, but it looked pretty physical. This being stopped me and said, I will let you have whatever it is you want in this life if you promised me never to raise your hand to any part of life and hurt anyone. And I said, okay. And the master, who I recognized, nodded and said, to you it is given, let it begin. And then this download started happening. I don't know how to relate that. Basically, immense amounts of information in archetypal or visual format, in symbolism, and I still probably would not even be able to recall 98% of it. But there's more to it than what I teach, but what I've managed to do for other people is tell them that it's based around the mythology of quantum physics. So when I started to learn that, that's a lot easier to convey than what I just said. And it's also a bridge where people can believe that as a starting point, as a reference for being able to do something different.
So are you saying, and don't let me put words in your mouth.
Oh, go right ahead.
Are you saying that with intention added to what we physicists call the observation effect,
mm-hmm.
you changed the quantum structure of a disease to where it was no longer a disease?
Well, I don't like to talk about disease, and the reason is because with that observation effect, you have a sense of dualities, you have polarities. And so if you're talking about disease or you're talking about healing, you're in a relationship with the other aspect of that polarity. So in order to transcend that, what I call the problem set, you have to go to a different game, which is not based upon your expectations of changing a disease or a condition. But what I teach people in the seminars, learn to notice whatever interests you, what you notice in the moment. And then, yes, exactly what you said, you realizing, and as physicists do, and I had a nuclear physicist in a class with me just yesterday here in Seattle, that we are composed of streams of photons. That's what we are. Now, I can go into the whole, if I need to for the listeners, I can go into why I say that. But if we're a stream of photons, and like you said, then the act of observation at the quantum level causes a conformational change in the patterns of the photons, then yes, the intent, focused intent with the observer effect does change physical manifestations, and instantly.
Yeah. I assume you're talking about entangled energy and the fact that you can change energy in your body and it will instantaneously change energy or matter in the other person's body if those particles are entangled or interacting. But doesn't there need to be some kind of sympathetic resonance with the receiver? How do you get that preparation in place?
It's absolutely true. There needs to be a sympathetic resonance with the receiver, but one of the things that I teach that Rupert Sheldrake talks about is we have access to something he calls morphic fields. Now, morphogenesis is well known in biology, and that describes the energy field around different species, and those species all have their own unique fields and appear to communicate through those fields. This is how you get things like what's called the Hunter's Monkey effect, where there's instant transformation of energy or transfer of energy and or a skill when a certain critical mass has been reached. Well, with matrix energetics, or I think with anything, you talk about the field of medicine or the field of engineering or so on, I believe there's a morphic field, which is a self-intelligent, self-organizing field of or pattern that updates with everyone that inputs energy of a light nature into that field. So what tends to happen at some point is you reach a threshold where just being in the presence of someone who holds that intent or that morphic field identity will start to cause entanglement at the quantum level and will bring about the changes you're talking about.
All right. Now, let me see if I can get back to this. If the person is ready to receive, open to receive, willing to receive. In other words, you can't violate somebody's free will with their, if they want to resist your entanglement, they can. You said by your mere presence, but
that's right.
Your presence has to be made aware to them, right? You can't just walk in a room and heal somebody against their will.
Well, I don't think it's against their will. I could argue that, and I believe in the same thing you said about free will, but free will, I think, is a lot more complex the equation. Whose free will are we talking about? Are we talking about the conscious mind? Are we talking about the programmed mind that's listened to commercials all of its life and believes in the ideas of disease? Are we talking about our educated mind that's gone to school and learned concepts in a certain way? Or are we talking about that higher mind or even the subconscious mind that has access to all other minds, all information, all times? That mind, I think, probably is in resonance with whatever the intent that might be expressed through my morphic field. If they're there, essentially, in that pattern, in that identity, they are asking at some level for help. Now, that's not to say that I go around helping people, healing people all the time. I don't even believe in healing, and I certainly don't believe I'm a healer. I think that transformation is a better term because healing, say if you have, say if you're blind. Let's take an extreme example. You're blind, and you come to somebody and you wish to be healed of your blindness, and you've heard this person's a fantastic healer, quote, and then nothing happens with your blindness. But what does happen is your inner sight or your inner awareness opens and you find this immense joy in life, or you start to become fascinated with a relationship, or you learn something new, or you're impelled to understand some new knowledge. That to me is transformation, or you could call it healing, but just not in the realm that you thought you were going to experience it.
In your experience, what's the range of this transformational influence?
It's very interesting because my students, and I have a few thousand now, and I guess I have a lot more now that the book Matrix Energetics is out and people are starting to read that and apply these principles, having never met me, the range is very interesting. People have done things with refrigerators. They've gotten their a mobile phone to upload and to work when not even an engineer could fix it. They've expanded the molecules, allegedly, in their gas tanks to make it somewhere that there's no way they should have been able to. They've healed or worked with animals that have been injured. They've had transformations in their mood, in their creativity, in their joy, the gamut of expression, really.
Wow. So what's the effective distance that you can do this from? In other words, if my mother-in-law calls me and says, hey, your father-in-law is having heart trouble right now, can you transfer some energy to him and see if you can't get him back on his feet? Can I do that from two states away, or do I have to be in the same room?
Well, certainly you could do that from two states away, because if we want to use the mythology of quantum physics, then you're talking entangled data. And entangled data, whether you're talking about the zero-point energy field or you're just talking about straight quantum physics, once you entangle something, the distance doesn't seem to matter whatsoever.
That's correct.
And your thought or your intent alone is enough to entangle that. Dr. Tiller, who wrote the foreword for my book, William Tiller, he says that he was changing data with dew point and pH and I believe it was temperature in controlled settings with experiments with entangled data just by merely thinking about it. And he has several books out about that.
I was actually talking to Dr. Jim Bell a month and a half ago, and we were talking about, he's the one that runs the Mars rovers up on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
Up at Cornell University, and he said the big drawback is that it takes a long time for the rover to upload its information to the orbiter, and then the orbiter's got to get around on the right side of Mars, boost the signal, send it to Earth, and it's got to receive it back, send it back down. I said, well, what you need there is a beryllium ion modem. He said, a what? I said, you know, using entangled particles as a binary switch. It's instantaneous, and it can overcome that distance.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it does to you and I. He was completely at a loss. I said, don't worry about it. It'll be built soon.
Yeah, I don't doubt that we probably are working on exactly those things. Someone talked to me, I guess I'm going to be on their radio program on Thursday, and he says that our government has already worked with these things, and some of the knowledge that I'm talking about and teaching is already high-level information and classified, and he knows because he's worked on some of those things. So I can't comment on that,
right.
But I will tell you that I think when an idea its time has come, then nothing can stop it. It's an awful good thing, too, because I was just reading that the FDA is planning something called a guidance document, which basically talks about bioenergetic fields as food and puts it under their regulation. That's insanity.
No, that is insanity. That's sort of like the whole black helicopter and food supplement conspiracies that are out there.
Yeah, I mean, name your conspiracy, but I mean that is, I mean, there, you know, somebody's going to be trying to control what you do, you think, you breathe, you eat. The thing is, with entangled data, you can't stop it. How do you stop a thought?
Yeah,
how do you stop something that has no measurable field?
There's no thought shield to it.
No.
This morphic field that's around a human, does it have a common shape?
Well, now, morphic field is different than morphogenetic field. The morphogenetic field, I assume it probably does have a common shape, but I can't say for certain. I would want to visualize it like the ovoid or egg of the aura. Of course, we're talking about an intact aura, not one that shows holes or has parts missing or entangled with other things. I mean, there's a lot of variation there. But the morphic field is more of a T field or a thought field, and I'm not sure that it does have a shape. It may take the shape of what you pour it into. And in other words, the concept you pour it into, the way you choose to use it, may very well shape the way it would appear, the way it behaves, and its functionality.
Do you think the functionality of it can be intended by the person to take on a shape, like, say, the Merkaba?
I would not be at all surprised that that's the case, yes. For instance, you've got exercises that the Tibetans have done, the Tibetan Qigong, and you've got the inner martial arts. You've also got practices of Western magic and many other things where they used symbolic shapes. They used certain types of exercises done a specific way. Well, what that does is it creates a ritual. The ritual creates its own access or key into that morphic field, and as long as you're performing according to that prescribed key, you have access to all that energy. So I would not be at all surprised if you couldn't shape it in very specific ways.
Do you think a person could have this morphogenetic field sensitivity or ability to manipulate this field on their own self?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I believe that. And I think that all sorts of studies have shown that. The problem I think that we get into is we start to make distinctions and say, well, this is that, and this is not that, this is this. And what I really think is going on is everything is more or less like a language. And once you get into the specific rules of that language, in other words, you get in rapport with that, it almost doesn't matter what you do. You will have access to that energy. You can basically shape it as you go.
Do you think sometimes this rapport can be somewhat subconscious?
Absolutely, and I think that's mostly the way it works. That's what I teach in the seminar. I tell people the closest you can get to being able to do matrix energetics effectively is by doing next to nothing. Because at the level of the conscious mind, we have 7 ± 2 bits of information available that we can process. Now, those bits could be quite large chunks of data, but still it's very limited. Now, I don't know which researcher made this up, but what they say is at the unconscious level, we have 11 million bits of data. And now, just exactly 11 million, not 12, you know. Who counted that? Come on, they're making it up. But it doesn't matter. It sounds good, and if it sounds good, I'm willing to believe it. I think it's probably more than that. But we can't even grasp the processing capacity that we have in our unconscious mind. The thing is would you rather work with what you know or what you don't know based upon that there's a lot more data involved with that 11 million bits? And if you start to access that and shape that into a morphic field, you have a powerhouse of information and energy.
Yeah, I'm thinking the same thing. I know very closely an example of an 11-year-old girl who was misdiagnosed and actually had a ruptured appendix, and they didn't find it out till she was about 11 days later. She should have been dead. But when they opened her up to do an emergency appendectomy, somehow this little girl had sent out a gel inside her peritoneal cavity and had encapsulated all the ruptured poison out of that appendix and adhered it to the inside of her peritoneal wall. So when the surgeon went in, all he really had to do was just gather up the gel and plop it in the pan, and there was no cleanup to do at all. It sutured her up, and she was good to go.
See, that's a fascinating skill. That would be something that we should teach, you know, children how to do. I think that we probably can do all sorts of things like that, but the problem is as long as we're tying into the rule set that says we can't, it makes it very difficult. Little children are going to have a lot easier time with something like that than you or I would.
Well, yeah, at least most people. I think I'd be pretty open-minded to it because I've seen a lot of really strange stuff that I'm now open-minded to much, much more. But I have to admit, when I came out of formal education, I was somewhat rationalized. I was, for lack of a better word, indoctrinated. And
absolutely,
things had to fit into a certain paradigm or they were not acceptable. And as a physicist, and mind you, I've just been a commercial scientist, not an academic, but I routinely see people in my field throwing data out because it just doesn't fit their data, their paradigm, their pattern.
Exactly right. And they do it unconsciously as well. I think every single one of those double-blind studies, there's no such thing as a double-blind study.
Somebody knows.
Yeah, I mean, at the unconscious level, everyone knows exactly what's going on. And besides which, there's a preformed assumption, this is what we're going to find when we're looking for this data. And if it doesn't work, then they just throw it out. Just like the cancer statistics, I'm sure you probably know, but for a long time now, they played a little shell game where they said the survival, 5-year survival rate was much better, you know, from the chemotherapy. But the thing they haven't said, and the thing I know, is that they throw out the data of anyone that dies within the 5-year period. So therefore, that data isn't considered, so therefore it makes the statistic look much better.
Well, it does tend to make the data look a lot better if you throw out the failures.
Yeah. Yeah, and the, you know, that's the thing I tell people in the seminar. I said, embrace the so-called failures. I take the same paradigm that the remote viewing community took, where there is nothing, there is no failure, there's only results and information. So this is why we like to use transformation as a metaphor for what they're doing, rather than pinning it to something that they will call healing. You understand, every one of us, if we were asked to describe the how we experience love, we would have completely different descriptions, because it's based upon our environment, our upbringing, our experiences, our romantic entanglements, right? All those things, and we then form our opinion, and then that creates, you know, our experience pretty much. So it's the same thing with healing or even with disease. Each person is going to have a different reality subset that they will fit that experience into. So if you use really fluffy language like transformation, then it kind of throws a monkey into that, and you don't exactly know what that means, which means anything can happen in the next moment, and it does tend to.
Well, I think it's much more than semantics, too. I think people do get kind of hung up on intuitive healing or whatever.
Chakra healing, or your chakra is the wrong color, or, you know. Yeah.
Take out a little sage, burn it, wave a little feather around, and the next thing you know, you feel better.
Well, you know, it's very funny that you say that, because someone was actually very upset with me. First thing she said is that this was a review on the Internet. It was very funny, on Amazon. And they came to some seminar I did and said, I didn't heal them of their problems. Well, the problem was, in the seminar, I'm really just trying to teach people how to learn the principles and how to be able to do this for themselves. And so I'm not really trying to heal anything. It's not my job there. But the other thing is they said, well, you invoke angels, but then you say they come at your beck and call. Well, angels are they're the servants of man, at least in the Bible, the way it's set up. Whether you believe in angels or not, you could say the construct or morphic field of angels do respond. That's their job. And so then she said, beware, Christians, you know, because angels don't respond immediately, demons do. And then she said, and then he was doing this without smudging the air with pine or something, whatever it was. And I'm just like, oh my God, Sage. I went, oh my God, can we be any more restricted in our belief system here?
Yeah. Well, in the dichotomy, I guess I'm going to call it a dichotomy, there's two words. You use the one, intention.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is attention.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're educating people to this concept of matrix energetics,
mm-hmm.
are you creating for them an attention set so that they can at least have something to focus on or something to bring up in their mind so that when they focus their intention on something, it's targeted?
Absolutely. And the way we start to do that, and it's an excellent question, we tell them. Now, it doesn't mean it's really true. This is a quantum mythology, but if you measure something at the quantum level, the act of measuring it, observing it by measuring it, changes it.
Sure.
Okay? That's a given. All right. So we tell people, let me just break it down real quick. You'll understand this. But the human body is made up of systems. Those systems then break down into organs that are part of those systems. Those organs are made up of biological tissues that are specific to those organs. You then have your organic molecules that make that up. You then have your atoms. Well, our model for the atom, we don't even have a real model for the atom. It's based upon something that was hundreds of years ago.
Yeah.
I can't remember the guy's name
Niels
right
Bohr.
Now. Excuse me?
Niels Bohr.
Well, not him, no. Yeah, he took it, though, from starts with the D, quite a long time ago, a Greek philosopher. That's where our model came from, and it basically, it's a solar system. So we found that we were working on the Manhattan Project, for instance. It took us a long time to get around that and figure out how to do what we wanted, because we were crippled by the idea that we were working with something that looked like a solar system.
Right.
And the truth of the matter is when we get down, say, just to the basic hydrogen atom, by the way, the proton and the neutron, very suspect, because they're held together by what they call weak and strong nuclear forces. The problem is that those forces are essentially conceptual because the proton and neutron do not fly apart. We have to hypothesize some reason why it doesn't fly apart, because it breaks all the rules. So therefore, we brought in the mathematical idea of weak and strong nuclear forces. There's a really excellent book about that called The Hidden Domain. I think it's Norman Friedman, and very interesting. But even if it weren't true, here's the thing. When we get down and look at the electron, there is no actual path of the electron. There's a probability orbit.
Sure.
And in fact, when we actually view it, it looks like a cloud.
Yeah, and it's not really an orbit. It's just a Heisenberg probability of location.
Exactly. Exactly. And it looks like a fuzzy cloud. There's no thing there. Now, we're still describing you and I. Now, here's my point. Here's my point. If that's, and then you go into the virtual particles, which, by the way, I virtually do not believe exist. It's like a German beer drinking song. You smash, you pull one down, smash it around, and then you've got more particles? No, I don't think so. But anyway, all of that can be explained if you just look at it as a field effect, and it's just the zero-point field, and then we're creating these things through consciousness, and they're popping in and out of existence, and that sustains our reality.
And that's pretty much what we see when we chill molecules down close to absolute zero. We take phosphorescent or X-ray fluorescent pictures of molecules, and we see that electrons don't really move about. They sort of blink in and out from one dimension to another,
right,
in a probable location, which creates a field and a very predictable way of molecules and atoms reacting. But one thing that you said, I want to make clear, that you know, protons are not all equal. They are, you know, quite different. There's a range of weights for protons.
Absolutely.
Hydrogen being the heaviest. Otherwise, Einstein's little formula there, E equals mc squared, wouldn't work for fusion. Or for fission, you know, once you form helium, which is putting two hydrogen protons together,
right,
if they didn't lose a little bit of mass in order to join, there'd be no reaction.
Exactly.
So the point is that probably no two protons are exactly alike, although very similar. There are some decimal points apart in weight, and they're made up of, if you really want to get down to it, just strings. They're just made up of vibrations that,
right,
that agree to come together in the 3D form of a proton.
And that's where it gets all too funny, because they agree to come together. Who agrees how, you know? And at what level are we talking about? I really think, honestly think, that if we were able to look at it, it's just us doing it. It's just consciousness. We're just part of this massive consciousness experiment that we call reality. And if you start to look at it that way, even if it were not true, but if you start to look at it that way, you create a set of beliefs, you energize those beliefs, that creates a structure or energetic field. That field then becomes a morphic field crammed with data, and it starts to become a lot like the Starship Enterprise with a fully charged phaser bank. When you direct focused intent, once you've built that to that level, it is like a laser, and it focuses in and targets whatever you focus on.
So I think you're really on to something here. What you're really saying is that all of us, as individual intelligences, are joint creators,
mm-hmm,
sort of a mass replicator. The combination of all of our consciousnesses and all of our agreements is what forms the matter that makes up this universe.
That's what I think.
And if one of us, one soul, were to leave the universe, the whole thing would fall apart.
Yeah, absolutely. But I will also say, since we are co-creators, if one of us, say myself or yourself, decides with a certain amount of authority that they create a reality, and then they create rules around that reality, and then they create procedures that follow those rules, just like an experiment in a lab, then we will actually see those things play out in physical matter, particularly if you get a high enough degree of coherence in that belief, in that structure, and then you have enough experiences which support that hypothesis to create that reality. And I think that's how all these techniques, like, oh, well, Reiki, and there's this and that, and there's millions of techniques and things out there. I think everything works on this principle. I don't think any of the drugs work at all. I think they work because the expectations of the scientists when they're building them are this molecule will do this. But what actually happens is when they get out there, those drugs are often recalled because they don't do what they thought they were going to do. And, in fact, they have these side effects they weren't looking at because they weren't looking for them.
Yeah,
they were looking for the benefit.
A la Viagra. started out as a heart medication and had a very strange side effect.
Very strange side effect.
Which I don't think is in your head, but...
Well, I tell people, I said, now don't get worried about this or you'll get performance anxiety and then you're going to have to imagine little blue pills floating in the air.
Well, so what we really have then is if we have an opportunity then, if we create awareness and training and impart of this knowledge to enough people, then you reach a point of critical mass or critical energy level with enough people thinking the same way, creating the same thing, now the future thread of the race changes.
Precisely. And I'll just say for my little Jenny on the block, my little part of the block right now, this is good for me and good for my students. But really, I know this is just a made-up thing. It's based upon an experience that I had. And then what I said is I looked at this and I said, okay, I know about 40 different techniques. What do all these techniques have in common? Well, they all work because the person that developed them said they worked. And so, and then if you do it just right, just like a religious practice, if you do it exactly right, you access the morphic field of that thing, the identity, and it performs exactly to expectations. So what you do is you build really powerful, big expectations, and then you create some sort of a evidence procedure that shows that you're actually getting what you think you're getting, and then you continue to develop that skill. And when you develop that skill, see, you're tapping into everyone else that's developing it as well. So we all reinforce each other with this massive grid of consciousness.
Well, it sounds like you have the makings of a fairly robust dissertation. Who is putting this case together?
Well, that would be me. You know, I read, I'm not a physicist, God forbid. Uh-huh. I mean, I can't do the math. But what I can do is do thought experiments like Einstein and imagine stuff. What happened to me is things kept getting stronger. From the moment I told you about that Superman story, the very next day, the very first person I touched, now realize I was a chiropractor, the very first person I touched, their vertebrae adjusted, their bodies moved, they had different things happen. That very first day after that happened, I had a line of people around my block waiting for me to touch them. I worked until midnight, I think, because I only had 2 days there in Montana. Then I had to go back to school and take a test. There's always a test when you're taking 31 credit hours. It never stops.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But anyway, I overextended myself, got pneumonia. I was sick for 2 weeks, and the very first person I touched, they turned around. They were there to give me a massage, and they were one of my clients. And they turned around, and they said, Richard, what is that energy? I said, oh, thank God, it's still there. Now, when I started reading the physics, and I read about 40 or 50 books and started to see commonalities, at least in the observer-based consciousness group of physicists, right? That's a small group, but it's a very significant group. Gottswami and Fred Allen Wolf and Dr. Killer and others, I started to see a thread there. I said, whether this is true or not, here is a really great belief system that drives and explains everything I'm experiencing. When I started to explain it in that way, I was able to teach the first person, then the next person, the next person. And it got away from this idea that we're physical, therefore we have to do something in linear time to a physical object to cause a physical effect and play by all the rules. Once you get to the idea that you're just working with consciousness, the rules completely shift to a quantum environment, and that means when you think a thing, you observe it, it occurs.
Well, how does a person work with their own consciousness? How do you raise that level of awareness in, and I guess we're talking about subconsciousness, really. How do you bring that to the conscious mind where you can intend its use?
Well, in my seminars, and that's the only thing I really am qualified to speak about as far as this question, I'll try and address it. For one thing, I wouldn't say I'm a hypnotist, but I'm very naturally good with confusing the conscious mind. So I speak in what's been called nested loops. I will start a story, not finish it, wander off to something else, wander off about five other places, and then bring it right back to the exact sentence I was on. This allows people to begin to let go of the fabric of the way they've constructed their conscious reality. Oh. Now, it helps the very fact that when I touch people, anybody, they tend to go unconscious or have very strong physical reactions that are quite dynamic and easily seen by all who are viewing. And then when that happens over and over again, what happens is you start to entangle that effect, and you start to get everyone wobbling within their reality in the room.
Yeah, now I've actually seen that wobble. I've seen people begin that wobble. I guess I got to ask a question now, though. Is the person that's being healed, or the person that's being...
That's having the experience.
Yeah, that's having the experience. They're ready to do this. They're prepared. They've got a certain amount of expectation. They've got a certain attention on the reception.
Actually, no. I meet people for the first time, and they know nothing about me. I'll give you an example, a fun example.
Okay.
I like to do face-to-face interviews. I'm getting comfortable now with being separate from someone and talking on a phone line. But when I'm there in a studio, I can actually reach out and touch someone. And not that I can't from a quantum perspective non-locality, but I can touch someone. When I touch someone, I touch them with the consciousness that they're a stream of photons. If I touch two places, I make a measurement. When I make a measurement, I collapse the wave function of the way they are structured, and they tend to go unconscious. They access the 11 million bits of data that they weren't accessing before. Now, when this happens and an interviewer experiences it, A, we have dead airspace, which is kind of fun, and then they come back, and then what they usually say is, let's begin that interview again. Wow, what just happened there? And that's always fun.
Huh.
No, dogs will respond to this. I have, in fact, in my book, The Matrix Energetics, I have pictures of a German Shepherd that was at one of my seminars, and for the purpose of the book, we brought the dog onto the stage before I taught that day, and you see me touching the dog in two points, and I'm just doing what I say. I'm measuring, actually, the tension between the two points, which allows me to make a measurement, an arbitrary measurement that we've designed to do that.
Uh-huh.
So when we do that, that goes into that quantum wave function. We collapse the field, and then what really happens, of course, the quantum wave function implies, as you know, that you're talking about infinite possibility. Everything that could happen does happen beyond time and space, but it is our observation that collapses it into a definiteness, or that probability that something will actually occur or exist. That's the way I understand it, anyway.
Yeah, and you have to be careful how far out you build that thread so that you allow whatever it is that your end game or your end focus, you allow the possibilities to occur to make that happen instead of designing the how from
exactly
where you are to the finished thing.
Exactly. That's why I tell people, what you do is you just imagine you go away and they go away. It's like if you dropped a pebble into a pond and then the ripples were to spread, you become the ripples. And they become the ripples. You entangle your ripples, and you think of nothing. You are not trying to do anything. You have listened to perhaps what they want, but then you notice what you notice. You get out of the way, and you stop thinking. There's no thought to the process. There's no force to the process. There is no desire or need to prove anything. It's merely getting out of the way. And when you do get out of the way, what I like to say is drop down, place intent, and let go. Dropping down means go more or less unconscious, place your intent as in a gentle little wave, and then let go and stop thinking about it. That's when transformation occurs. So you can actually see this German Shepherd on these photographs, and they're sequential, start to smile, his head dips, and then he starts to fall down. And if they allowed us to have the final picture, he was upside down with a smile on his face, more or less unconscious. And I had a poodle, a standard poodle, big dog, and it was having epileptic seizures, and I just touched it, and it also went unconscious, and it didn't have seizures anymore. Much easier with a poodle. They haven't been told by a doctor that they have this condition and they have to take this medication for the rest of their life.
You know, it's funny. It just came to my mind. I had my oldest son was about, I think 2.5 years old, and my oldest daughter was playing with the baseball bat one day, and, well, one thing led to another, and... your oldest son got the split above his eye, and we took him to our friend who was a doctor, and she said, yeah, he's going to have stitches. So, you know how little kids are, and we papoosed him, put him down on a little Velcro board, and secured his arms. Well, he just, you know, red-faced, panicking. You know, here comes somebody with a Novocaine needle at my forehead. And I really didn't know what to do. So I just reached down and touched his forehead, and he instantly, I mean, from a purple face screaming rage, he took one breath and went fast asleep.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about.
And the doctor was able to numb the laceration, stitched it up, and when she snipped the final thread, he opened his eyes. And we just unstrapped him, and 5 minutes later, he was riding his tricycle with stitches over his eye. I don't know how that happened, but that's what I intended to do.
Exactly. And that's the key. You intended to do it. With what I'm teaching with Matrix Energetics, one of my key goals is to have this technology or consciousness in the hands of parents and children for exactly those sorts of things. One of the radio interviewers that met me a few years back, and I've done quite a few interviews here in Seattle with him, he has a son, little guy, and he took my course, except for he's a radio guy, so he tended to host the seminar rather than pay attention. You know, he was introducing everybody to everybody else. Anyway, I guess he paid enough attention. He was at the mall, and being a dad, he wasn't as careful as mom. And he took the minivan and accidentally closed the side door of the minivan on his son's fingers.
Ouch.
Now, he literally, and he heard his child screaming, he literally thought that he was going to look down and see severed fingers on the ground. And then he said, no, what would Richard do? And he says, I know, think of the first thing that occurs to me, which is something we teach. He saw flower buds budding out from the fingertips. He also went back in time. We teach a conceptual time travel technique where he went back into time before the injury occurred. Instantly, this child, Jaden, stopped screaming and looked down at his hand. And his hand started to get really red and warm. And by the time they got home, which was 5 minutes later, he went to show his mother, my friend Cameron. He said, show your mom, you know, your hand. He couldn't remember which one it was.
Yeah, no.
That's worth it all, right there.
We have about 10 minutes in this hour left, and one thing that you said at the very beginning is just now, it's a good time to bring it back up because this just really, really fits. You mentioned that you had a download.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a similar situation, but rather than make the show about me, I'd like to hear about how that happened. How did you feel? What did you get? Images? Did you get sounds? Tell me about the download.
Okay, I haven't mentioned this to very many people, but since it happened to you, that's probably why I said it. It was near my birthday, and I've been in this spiritual environment and activity, believing in angels and masters and things like this, masters of the Far East and the West. And basically, what happened is I had these masterful beings walking in and out of my energy field where I could actually see them with my inner eye, and I'm not that clairvoyant, or I wasn't then, and it was like an open house where they were greeting me, they were telling me things. This went on for over 6 hours. When I lay down on the bed, there were images flashing through my mind. There were words showing me pictures of archetypes and telling me what each one of these things did. So I'd get a geometric figure, or I'd see a hand position, and then I would hear information about that. Now, that download, I think, is still going on, and I think that was before I made some of the distinctions that I have now made that allow me to teach this to anyone. But I'm pretty sure that set the tone for what I'm doing now. It was divine intervention. It was very friendly. It was very personable. It was almost physical. It was a very powerful experience.
Do you find, I'm asking this for personal reasons, I guess, mm-hmm. Do you find the download sometimes comes in, another language?
I would say that part of that, and I hate to say this because I really don't understand it, but a lot of it was in high math and geometric shapes and feelings. Yes, I have had things come in another language, but only the higher part of me would be able to interpret that data.
Was there a color to it?
There were a lot of colors. Blue and violet are predominant, but they're part of my spiritual tradition. It was like a warp bubble of fascinating colors and shapes and sounds, and then again, beings walking in and out of my energy field.
Now, what was your physical sensation? I mean, were you asleep? Were you awake? Were you in meditation? How did that occur?
Well, I was driving my GTO through snow-encrusted roads coming down a mountain pass.
Well, that could be a spiritual experience.
Well, it certainly can. I pulled alongside the road. This master stopped me in the middle of the road. And again, I saw it with my third eye, but it was enough to physically make me stop my car. And touched me on the third eye and said, let it begin. And then the first act I ever did in what I now call matrix energetics, I have a torch rib cage and an extra vertebrae. Now, I haven't tried to fix the extra vertebrae. It's just kind of disturbing to even mess with that. But my torch rib cage caused chest pain on my left side and quite a bit of discomfort. And I was instructed to take two fingers, one on each hand, and to touch two places and to then just relax, kind of go into a meditative focus. And I'm not talking about running energy. I'm talking about instant change. My ribs cracked and popped and moved, and they were quite hot, you know, from the experience. And that was the first, and I had tears running down my face, and that was the first time I ever experienced this energy for myself.
Now, which mountain was it you were coming down?
You know, it was, Big Sky. It wasn't a big mountain. It was just Big Sky, Montana, which is right outside of Bozeman, Montana. Hmm. Wasn't a steep path or anything. It certainly wasn't Tibet or anything like that.
I just got back from Tibet.
I know that. That's why I said that.
I'm still reeling from it. Frankly, I, you know, 23 hours in the air and airports.
Oh my gosh!
You just kind of jet lag into an altered state. But standing in what's called the Rim of Power, which is in the middle of the Himalayas, and you have all these mountains all the way around you, and the short ones 21,000 feet, and they go up from there. That's an amazing feeling. You're above where life grows, and yet you feel this life force that's so unbelievable.
Sounds fantastic.
I really can't put it into words.
Sounds fantastic.
Well, it is, but thank goodness for Diamox, because that altitude will get you after a while.
I was going to say, I would have trouble with that altitude, I would think. I went to Denver, and my breathing was not so happy.
Well, I'm an asthmatic since I was a little kid. It's controlled, but I will tell you that for 11 days I didn't get below 13,000 feet, and I had no problems.
That's great.
I had none. I mean, yeah, hiking up 1,000 steps, you have to stop about every 100 steps and catch your breath. But as far as restriction, as far as vasoconstriction, it wasn't there. It just didn't occur.
That's a blessing.
It really was. Well, my guest has been Dr. Richard Bartlett. I'd love to have you back on the program. An hour just is not enough to do justice to subjects like this. Do you have any books out or a website you'd like to
I do, and in fact, it's very fun. My book, Matrix Energetics, just came out about 10 days ago. I appeared on Coast to Coast, and I'm sure this radio show will do the same. Basically, my book sold out. It's now in its second reprinting. It'll be available in a couple of days. You can get it now on Amazon. You can also go into your local bookstores and like Barnes & Noble and what's the other one? Borders, and they have it.
Borders, Walden Books.
My website is matrixenergetics.com. We do teach seminars. I have one coming up in New Jersey, May 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st. And the experience is not to be believed. For one thing, I'm being more sedate than I actually am when I teach, because it is a wild experience. People are liable to be seeing colors vibrating through walls. I mean, feel like they're vibrating through walls.
Do you let talk radio hosts come to these kind of seminars?
Oh, you bet. Please. You would certainly be my guest.
I might do that.
I'd love that.
That actually might fit my time schedule. I have to be in Hawaii the 10th through the 15th to speak, but...
Yeah, get to be in Hawaii is the way to say that. Yeah. If you live in Seattle, if you get to be anywhere where the sun actually shines, you think it's a miracle.
Oh, man. Well, I greatly appreciate you being on the program, and we'll have links to this website and to his book, Matrix Energetics, on our website at X Squared Radio. And it's been my pleasure to have you on the program. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.
Thank you very much. Do you archive these things? Because I'd love to have a copy of our interview.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we archive them. I am not able to upload it from here, but tomorrow I will upload it, and it'll be available. And I always give the MP3s to the guests so they can do with it whatever they want to do.
Fantastic.
And then they can listen, you know, I think I charge $1.67 a month for people to go into the archives and listen, but you can post the MP3 on your website if you like. And
we'll also link you over to our website. And I have to say, this has been one of the most fun interviews I've had. Thank you very much.
Oh, that's great. Well, you know, I don't come from the broadcast world. I'm a physicist that wrote a book, and the book became popular, and somebody said, gee, you might like to have your own radio program, and that was 17 months ago, so... I'm having a ball with it. I've sort of made a metamorphosis of my own, and just sitting here with some cross thought and some multidisciplinary skills allows me to communicate with people at your level, on a entertaining level, I hope.
It was entertaining for me, and I always look at something first and say, am I having fun?
Yeah.
And then I try to make it fun for everybody else.
Exactly. Well, I can feel the energy from here, and it's been a pleasure having you on the program.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, my friends, we will come back right after these messages, and we will have Maureen St. Germain on the program. We'll be talking about our trip to Tibet, so don't go away. We'll be right back in about 6.5 minutes. And this is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. You've existed for thousands of years. The new book in the Universal Learning Series by Sandy Andrew, called Your Never-Ending Life, will shine light on memories you once dismissed as impossible. When you're finished with this book, you will realize why and how you can relish all the beauty and sadness in all your lives. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. You can find the book easily by clicking the Universal Learning Series banner at X Squared Radio. Just about everyone owns an inkjet printer. You could buy a printer for less than a couple of tanks of gas, but the inkjet cartridges are costly. If you buy a color and black cartridge at a national superstore, you'll spend about $80. Well, those high-priced days are now over. If you click the 123 inkjet banner at X Squared Radio, you may be able to replace a cartridge for the price of movie admission for two. Plus, every time you shop at 123 Inkjets, you get a chance to win a free printer. How cool is that? Add to that the free shipping, and you have an untouchable bargain. Next time you run low on those vibrant color inks, think of X Squared Radio and start saving money. You know, thus is the place where the past meets the future. If you have done your genealogy and found that you have roots in the Irish or Scottish clans, then don't you think it would be a great idea to have a replica of your family crest? You can get a coat of arms, a ring, or even a family tartan that may help you or your grandchildren remember your ancestors.
Thus is the time when the hearts of the children are turned to the hearts of the fathers. We only carry the best. So if you're ready to experience the glory of your past, you're ready to visit Scottish Heirlooms at X Squared Radio.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew coming to you live from Los Angeles. Just got back from a 19-day, I won't call it a vacation, an expedition to Tibet. And I actually attended a group outing by, it was sponsored by a Marine Saint Germain, Transformational Enterprises. And we just returned just a few hours ago, and would like to give you an update how that went. So are you awake, Maureen?
I am. I'm fully present and ready to talk.
Wow. What a time we had for 19 days.
Yes, I agree. I think the biggest part of this expedition was adjusting to the altitude. And once we all had those adjustments, and that's no small feat, then the explorations we did, the people we met, the things we saw were quite remarkable. And it's almost as if Tibet is a place out of time. The feudal system and the old way of doing things is still so strong compared to what we know in the West. And it's almost as if it's been perpetuated by the old way simply because no one bothered to challenge it.
Well, I guess one of the things that we noticed right away is that the country government seems to be in a state of, I don't want to call it occupation, but it is being controlled by the communist Chinese, is it not?
Yes, it is. It is what they call the Tibet Autonomous Region. And in 1950, the Chinese government marched into Tibet and forced Tibet, the government of Tibet, to make an agreement, a seven-point agreement, that would allow for China to protect Tibet and to rule over Tibet. In exchange, Tibet was allowed to keep its own government and its own language and that type of thing. And that was pretty peaceful coexistence for about 6 years. And then things began to change.
What was it? Was it their religious leadership? Was Tibet's original religion, Tibetan Buddhism, was it tied into their governmental system as well?
Yes, indeed. The Dalai Lama was both the political head and the spiritual head. So it would be like the Pope who runs all of Rome or all of Europe, let's say. So it's the system dates back to a time historically that is similar to what we know and have seen in Europe. But Europe broke through that with the revolution, and the struggles between modern Tibet and old Tibet were similar in that regard. One of the things that we did was interview a man by the name of Tashi Tering, who loved Tibet and wanted to see change in Tibet, and even though he was a loyal Tibetan, ended up being accused falsely of not being loyal to Tibet and ended up in prison. And he still went on. He's in his 90s now, and he has built 9 or 10 schools with his own money, with permission from the Chinese. And the other thing I want to say is the Cultural Revolution was this massive undertaking by Mao to attempt to squelch his opponents, but using others to create chaos amongst themselves. So that anybody who was not for total change, complete abolition of all things in the past, were suspect. So it was a very difficult time of trial and tribulation. Lots of monasteries were destroyed. Lots of people died. And it was a very, very difficult time.
Well, I know we visited a lot of those monasteries, and we heard the stories about how the communist Chinese limit the number of people that can actually become monks, because they don't want 10,000 monks in a monastery. And some of the monasteries we visited that had 10,000 monks at one time now have like 800 monks. But the remarkable thing was, even though some of the monasteries were completely destroyed, and we saw some of that, some were only partially destroyed, and the more fascinating parts of the monasteries were left intact. And one of the things that we saw in commonality from monastery to monastery was a very strange structure, similar to the way the Egyptians treat their dead.
The structure is what they call a stupa, and it is where they buried their religious leader, the Dalai Lama. Now, the Potala Palace, which is one of the most famous structures in all of Tibet, and certainly was the tallest building in the world until probably the modern 20th century, that building housed the remains, the mummified bodies of the Dalai Lamas from the 5th Dalai Lama onward to the 11th. And those structures that they were housed in or encased in, inside the Potala Palace, is a structure called a stupa. And the stupas had, each stupa had its own room or its own specific area within this building. And that is what has got us thinking about how similar their pattern of venerating the holy men of the past, the equivalent of the king, with elaborate structures to house their embalmed remains, and what they put on the walls above them and around them and the shape of the stupas were remarkably similar to things that we know today to be something different.
Well, I know one of the structures we went to wasn't the oldest, but it was in the second largest city in Tibet. And we actually went up inside a stupa building, and it was created as a mandala. Now, a lot of people know what a mandala is. They look at it as a medallion or a pattern on a piece of paper, or maybe if you've seen the movie The Last Mimsy, you'll have an idea of what we're talking about, a mandala. But the funny thing about a mandala is it wasn't originally two-dimensional, flat on a piece of paper. This was a three-dimensional building with 108 rooms in it, and that a Dalai Lama or a Panchen Lama who could visualize going through these 108 rooms or 108 levels would achieve enlightenment. But there was a really peculiar, at least from a physicist's point of view, that construction of this stupa at the top that had a very familiar shape to it. What was that?
Well, that shape looked remarkably similar to Stargate in our minds. And the mandala itself is a term that is often used to denote a circular piece of art that is a point of reflection. Just like somebody might walk in a labyrinth and get a point of reflection, a mandala's intention is to draw the observer in. And in the case of this particular building that we're speaking of, not only was it a walking mandala that you could move from room to room, and it would take sometimes weeks or months to do that. You'd have to keep coming back as you move through the rooms. But from the air, it looked like a sand mandala that is all too familiar with what we've seen with Buddhism. The stupa itself had a quality that had like a capstone on it, and then a point like an antenna, and then two stabilizers on either side of that, and then above that was a secondary mandala within the building itself that you could look up into.
I think what I remember, some of these things are like 12 to 15 meters high, and they're built just like a Tesla coil. They look just like a Tesla coil. At the top, you've got a nice round ball, and darned if the thing isn't made out of gold as well.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these weighed over 4,300 pounds of gold.
Yes. And then,
of course, this thing's inside a building, and painted on the ceiling right above this thing, as though it was aiming at it like a big arrow, is this four-dimensional mandala. Sort of like, okay, whoever walks in this room, we want you to know that this Tesla coil we've built is an instrument by which the soul of this llama that's buried inside this gold arch underneath it is going to be transferred through dimensions using this device.
And that's precisely what was done in Egypt as well. Clear intention that a path be made straight away to some other point through a portal. And that portal we call a Stargate.
Now, the interesting thing about this, I think, is this Tibetan Buddhism is not really that old, historically speaking.
Well, certainly not as old as Egypt.
No, I mean, what was it, the six Dalai Lamas, the one that actually started Buddhism in Tibet. The first through the fifth, we don't really know a whole lot. In fact, the first one was declared a Dalai Lama posthumously.
Well, it was in the 7th century that Songtsen Gyambo brought the Tibetan Empire to these places of Buddhism, and he began transforming the civilization from this feudalism and a military kind of environment to something more peaceful and spiritual. And what he did is he went to the nearby lands around him, investigating the major civilizations of Asia. And then he imported Mahayana Buddhism, which then provided the cultural background for the development of a social structure. At the same time, he married 9 princesses who from the surrounding countries, including Nepal and China, asking each to bring a Buddhist artifact so that the devotion to Buddha would be almost instantaneous because there was a thread coming from the queen. And that was the development of Tibetan Buddhism.
Well, I found it so incredibly interesting that they incorporated sacred geometry, that they incorporated such meticulous attention to detail and engineering in building these stupas, even though it would be sort of like us going out making a granite widescreen TV. The granite TV wouldn't really be functional, but it would look just like a widescreen TV. What you got the impression was, because I'm telling you, people, we drove hundreds and hundreds of miles over the most remote roads, way up. 17,000 feet was as high as we went, and the lowest we went was about 12,000 feet. All these stupas look the same. They copied some kind of pattern, some kind of instrument that they saw work at some time.
I agree. There was no evolution. You know, in Egypt, you can sometimes trace an evolution of this pyramid came before this pyramid, or this burial site came after this burial site, just by looking at the artifacts. But these all had a very remarkable, similar quality, as if they were using the same design, the same floor plan.
Right.
And that was pretty stunning, that it would be the same consistently, you know, to go from zero to this.
Yeah, there was no predecessor. There's no, I mean, it's like irreducible complexity. One day they were living in mud huts, and the next day, literally, boom, here's this high technology representation with, you know, 10,000 jewels in it, you know, stacked. I believe, what was the tallest one we saw? Was it in the Patala?
Yes, and there are certain things that we had good fortune to see, and we got to be careful how we talk about these things, but the structures looked like a set of flat. To describe it to the radio listener, where we would be looking at, if you could imagine, a set of gift boxes that are square in their base, and then maybe anywhere from 2 to 5 feet high, and then the next box above it would be slightly smaller, as if it was a stairway. But it wasn't a stairway, it was simply stepped up. And then a number of those box-like pieces made up the base. And then that those bases were studded with jewels and ornamentation, not words, but a lot of precious and semi-precious jewels. And then at a certain point, there was a rounded piece that sat on top of the higher boxes. And again, this was one piece, but it's just to give a visual for people. And that higher piece looked a bit like the top of a Dairy Queen cone. And it had a rounded nature to it, and it had height to it. And then above that was a smaller structure, which was the actual encasement of the Lama's physical body. And then above that was a needle that had this quality of looking like Brooks has described as Tesla coil. And then above that was the ceiling, which was another three-dimensional mandala painted on the ceiling.
I thought that was utterly amazing. Now, the other thing is that from Tibetan medicine to objects of veneration and worship, they have gods and they have Buddhas and they have Taras, enlightened beings who are teachers and who are leaders and who are examples of great compassion at all kinds of levels, a very, very compassionate kind of deity structure.
This is true, and we have the stories of Buddha. We have the three Buddhas known as the past, present, and future Buddha. We saw a very large statue of the future Buddha, which is also called Lord Maitreya. And we also saw many paintings on the walls that were beautifully done, very, very well preserved, and the places that were not destroyed. And we had places where we saw the Taras, which are the female version of perhaps Mary or Kuan Yin, the equivalent of the being of light who is the grantor of all wishes. We had many opportunities to experience the Buddha of healing, which is a dark blue. And what was so, you know, you can go into a beautiful Catholic church, for example, in Europe and see beautiful icons and be struck and inspired just by the sheer beauty of the art. And the structures we saw in Tibet were on a scale that were easily double or triple or 10 times what we would see in the West in a beautiful cathedral. So
oh,
we were
sure.
looking at statues that were anywhere from, you know, 30 feet to 100 feet. And that the sheer magnitude reminded me of Upper Egypt, where they had very large statues of Amun so that it would scare away the enemies. But in this case, these structures were objects of devotion and ritual.
We had a great privilege, and if you get a chance to go to Tibet with Maureen St. Germain next year, if she puts together this expedition again, you need to get yourself in early and get in on this. Now, it is not a trip for the pansy. This is a tough trip, and it's a little bit like going to another planet because altitude sickness is nothing to laugh at. Trust me, we had 11 very, very seasoned travelers, and six of them fell to this weakness at some time or another during our expedition. So it's not anything to laugh at, and you really have to be in condition to go. But I so recommend it because we had, in my opinion, the two best guides on Earth for this trip. Can you tell us a little bit about those men?
Sure. The American guide that we used is a man by the name of Gary Wintz, who is probably one of the first Americans to have been in China after the occupation. He and his former partner, Molly, were the first Westerners to visit Tibet or to live in Tibet in the 50s after the takeover. He spent time initially as a teacher of English. He's led many expeditions all over the world. He is a remarkable individual. He has many contacts. He has intimate knowledge of the culture and the way of life. He understands the politics. He understands the individuals. He knows people. He was able to open doors that maybe others would not be able to.
Yeah,
and then our Tibetan guide.
Yeah, go ahead.
Our Tibetan guide, Unsala, was a man who was remarkably compassionate and loving and...
Now, he was Tibetan, right?
Yes, he was.
Okay. But he spoke English very well.
He spoke English very well. He was truly a guide, and he worked with a company, and very, very capable man who gave us many things in terms of understanding and comprehension.
Well, they also open doors.
Yes, but we have to be careful about what we say on the air, Brooks. You know, we don't realize how your listeners are all over the world, and we don't want to make any problems for anybody, so I don't want you to say too much. Let us just say that, you know, we had wonderful meetings with wonderful people. We had an opportunity, for example, to visit a nunnery and to sit with the nunnery in their chanting hall and talk with them about what they knew, and we asked them to teach us a chant. Now, because the trip was difficult, we had a number of our group who were specifically taking a different route. Instead of going over those particularly high passes that day, they took a softer route, which was a paved road instead of a bumpy road over a high pass. And they told us later that they could feel the energy shift when we were in the chanting hall with the nuns. And the nuns let us sit with them in the chanting hall and then taught us a Tara chant, which we were very fortunate to sing. Then we taught them one of our chants, which they also sang with us. And it was a lovely, lovely experience. So we had many opportunities to get to know the Tibetan people and the Tibetan culture and get to experience life in modern Tibet, which isn't all that modern. We also went over the beautiful passes where we saw the sapphire blue lake. Do you remember that? Lake Yamdrok?
Oh, right, right. The turquoise lake.
And amazingly, Brooks is standing on the top of this mountain where we've climbed up to overlook this beautiful, beautiful lake. And we're very high up. And we're looking at the iron ore on the ground below us, and yet the lake is blue-green. And you had something to tell us about that.
Well, we were actually standing on an iron mountain. This thing was, it had so much iron in it, it was rusting. It was literally iron oxide on the outside of this mountain. And the wind was blowing 30 to 40 miles an hour. So we sort of ducked behind one of the cliffs on the mountain. So we were standing above this turquoise-colored lake. And so we were shielded from the wind, and we decided to shoot a little bit of film. And I looked down at the water, and I said, wait a minute. If all these mountains around here are made of iron, why is the water green? And then I remembered what makes water green. At this altitude, people, it's not algae. It's copper. So somewhere upstream was a copper mountain that was leaking copper oxide into the water, turning it green. So this is a land, although desolate, is completely rich in every respect at a base level in minerals.
In minerals, yes. And the geology behind it, as it was explained to us, is that at one time India was not part of the continent where Tibet is. And as India moved westward, it pushed into Tibet and pushed the Tibetan plateau into its current position, which made it very high, which is why everything in Tibet is, you know, we're looking at starting at 4,000 feet in Kathmandu, which is Nepal, and then the very first city we stayed in was Lhasa, which is 12,000 feet. And we never went below 12,000 feet until we got to the last city of Zagmu, which is at, again, the Nepal border on the other side near the Friendship Bridge. So the whole Tibetan plateau, or the Tibetan autonomous region, is remarkably higher than the rest of the surrounding land. This is why they call it Rooftop of the World.
So So bordering the Himalayas, which are arguably the tallest mountains on Earth, Mount Everest being somewhere around 29,000 feet, 8,844 meters. I remember that because it's on the
on the baseball camp you bought.
Yeah. What causes the mountains to go up that high?
Well, as the landmass of India moved into the continental shelf, it literally pushed that land upward. It crushed it and pushed it out of the way, so it squeezed it up. Just like if you took a ice cream cone and squeezed in the middle, you'd end up with a point on the top.
So this land that makes up these mountains at one time may have been at sea level.
Indeed, and that's what archaeologists tell us, because they find all kinds of seashells. And in fact, the conch shell is most sacred in Tibet and can be readily found for that very reason.
That's really interesting. I do a fair amount of diving, and those conch shells are pretty difficult to find, mostly because divers go down and get them. But that is one of the eight auspicious symbols for Tibetan Buddhism, is the conch shell. Kind of strange for a land that doesn't begin until it gets to 10,000 feet.
And then you add to that a building such as the Patola Palace, which was a very, very tall building, way taller and built by hand with the without the help of machinery, and it's an astounding accomplishment. I think one of the things that struck me about the Patola, just to dovetail back a little bit, is I was not prepared for the beauty and the majesty and the art and the sacredness that I found inside that building. I don't know what I was expecting, but I was totally unprepared for everything we saw there. I was stunned at how immense, how beautiful, and vast in terms of size of scale.
Yeah, I had seen pictures of the Patala, and I actually saw the building in a dream when I was a little kid. I had no idea what I was looking at, but there was, of course, no internet, and it wasn't in history books or anything. I just remember seeing it. And so when the opportunity to come to Tibet with your company was made available to me, I jumped on it because I always wanted to see that building. And I got to tell you, that is one heck of a climb up those stairs. But when I got to the top and looked out over the valley with Lhasa stretched out below it, you felt the majesty and power of this mountain and the people that built upon the mountain. You know, even in Christian scriptures, you hear God telling the prophets, you know, get ye to the mountaintops to receive my message. Well, there is no mountaintop anywhere near the Old Testament times that can compare to what the Himalayas and what the high Tibetan plateau can do as far as getting you high up next to the stars.
Yes,
people knew where power was.
That's true. And in fact, one night, Brooks took us out on the roof and gave us a little astronomy lesson, which was quite valuable, quite interesting. Looking at the stars from a place as remote as Tibet is one of the most exquisitely beautiful things a person can do. There's no ambient light to take away from what you're looking at.
Yeah, that night we were in Shigar, right?
That is correct.
And it was a hotel, but there was no heat. It was about 24, 25 degrees on the roof. It was about 24, 25 degrees inside the hotel.
Actually, that was Sagmu. I made a mistake here. Shigatse, maybe. Yeah, Shigatse. Go ahead.
Well, that was the hotel was at Shigar. It was a truck stop area. We stayed the night there before we went on. We'd left Shigatse, which was the second largest city in Tibet, drove all day long and got into Shigar, or Shigar, S-H-I-G-A-R. And to say we had hot water would be an overstatement. It was a good breakfast. But the Milky Way laid out over top of us, you would think that the stars would look the same no matter where you are on the planet, but we were, 12,000 miles to the east of where we're used to seeing them in, on the west coast here in the United States. So everything looked different, so it took a little while to get located. But, you know, I had a pointer laser, and we were able to see some satellites go over, and it was kind of very neat, but very cold. And the next morning, we had a big surprise when we went to start the bus.
Yes. Yes. Our bus driver had fueled the bus early the night before when we had gotten in, and apparently it picked up some bad fuel, and it had clogged the fuel line and the fuel pump. And thankfully, Brooks is a man of many talents, and he eyeballed the situation and knew right away what was wrong. So he made a recommendation, and they all did their little thing. And a couple hours later, they finally decided to follow his suggestion. And then we got on the road.
Well, it was a Cummins diesel. I mean, gosh, how far wrong can you go there?
Yes.
But anyway, we got the bus back on the road and traveled at a blazing speed of 40 kilometers an hour over dirt roads for days and days, and I'm not talking about smooth dirt roads, I'm talking about potholed dirt roads, and we're not talking about straight dirt roads either, are we, Maureen?
No, we're not. We're talking about switchbacks, and of course, anybody who's lived on any mountainous region knows that switchbacks are the backbone of getting across a mountain pass, and so you get to a certain point where you have a clear shot, that's the pass itself, but getting up to that point is the switchbacks, which are very challenging to navigate on any kind of a vehicle, much less a big tour company bus.
But we had an outstanding driver.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. Yes, yeah. There were a few people in our group who were a little concerned.
Well,
had to close their eyes a few times.
The way he would thread that bus in between goats, and they had a vehicle that they made. I know you're going to laugh, folks, but this is really serious. They had a vehicle that could be described as a rototiller, okay? Two tires, you know, with the handles that come up in your hands and the controls. And they used a little towing feature to tow a wagon, which they actually sit on. So we saw these two-wheel rototiller vehicles all over Tibet and Nepal.
Right. And they would load their goods, their family, whatever needed to be transported on these little flatbeds that literally were the equivalent of two pieces of a trailer and that little tractor type situation that was kind of built together into one unit. A very efficient kind of equipment, truly.
Very functional.
Yeah.
Very functional and a lot of fun to watch. You know, it was a it is not, as I said, a trip for the lighthearted, but if you're an adventurer, and I think most of Earth explorers that listen to this program are, this is a trip for you. This is a different planet. You're going to be going to an area of the planet that few Westerners really get to see. It's tough. You know, you talk about going to base camp and going up to Everest. You'll meet those folks. But believe me, you earn no less respect going across the Tibetan Plateau. It is really a great challenge.
Yes, and one of the first things we did when we first got there is we made a charter flight available to anyone who wanted to fly, and we went out early in the morning and flew over those very mountains that we would end up trekking later in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun for me because, you know, in the West, you don't get anywhere close to the cockpit of an airplane anymore.
Oh, yes.
But in Tibet, there's no cockpit door. And so they just invite you on up into the cockpit. So guess where I was with my video camera?
In the cockpit. And as a matter of fact, I saw some of that video that Brooks shot in the cockpit. And those of you who get to see it are truly blessed indeed. You're going to feel like you're Superman flying over those mountains. No plane, nothing between you and the mountains. Quite amazing.
Yep. Yep. Well, I went with sort of a dual purpose. I always wanted to see Tibet, but as you know, putting together the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition is not just about going to the North Pole. It's about putting together all of the roots of both metaphysical, religious, and geological
remnants.
Yeah, of Hollow Earth theory. And, you know, regardless of what we were able to get out of the monks, and what we were able to get out of different experts that we talked to, both scientific and medical, there is clearly in the Tibetan Buddhist symbolism an idea that there's a lot more to the earth than what geologists say there is.
I would agree. I would agree. There's a great sense of order and organization and pathways in. It's not simplistic like one would think.
Well, it's not so shamanistic as many religions are. It is very ordered, and it's very it's not so mystical in the sense that there's magic involved. There's a science to it. There is a great amount of physiology that's incorporated into their drawings. Many of their medical drawings that we saw in the hospital were ancient and extremely accurate on organs of the body, muscles of the body, bones of the body, acupuncture points of the body. Incredibly detailed, high technology incorporated into their religion.
Yes, and this is a very interesting thing. Many people have heard of the word tankas, which are the colorful Buddhist banners that Buddhists hang in their homes as like a point of an icon or a religious picture. But they also use tankas as teaching structures. And because so many of the people were illiterate in our modern sense, in other words, they didn't have a language or an alphabet the way we use in the West, they used iconography. So every medical fact was represented by an image that represented it. And they used ideas, for example, if a certain root was the healing herb for a particular ailment, it showed up in the picture itself. So that as the medical student, the Tibetan medical student, for example, or the Chinese medical student, they were also Chinese medicine that was taught at this hospital, the imagery was very clear so that the student would be able to learn to memorize this information easily. And then the pharmacy we went into was quite amazing.
Well, tell us how accurate it was that the holding techniques that a traditional Tibetan doctor might have, and holding onto his wrist and the fingers, and what could he tell about the body?
It's a very curious thing. The first thing they did was they showed us how they diagnose, for example, and they would bend a person's, they'd hold someone's arm out, and the doctor would be facing the person as their arm was extended. Then they would bend this person's hand at the wrist, and they would mark where the first ringlet was, or where the first circle, where the first fold came of the bracelets of the wrist. The natural bracelets that occur in the skin folds. And then the doctor would place his index finger in that position, and then he would place his second finger in the next position next to it, and the third finger and the fourth finger. And much like a clarinetist might put his fingers on the precise keys in order to produce a set of tones, the doctor could actually feel the organs themselves in their aliveness. And one of the most remarkable stories we were told by our guide was that a gentleman who offered his hand for diagnosis was analyzed, and the doctor finally, after a few minutes of being very puzzled, said, you know, it's very strange. I'm not getting a reading on your kidney. Or I'm not sure whether it was his kidney or his spleen. But
yeah, it was the kidney.
It was his kidney. And the man smiled and said, I had my kidney removed a few years ago. And how could you have known that?
That was just completely remarkable that here was this doctor who was saying, you know what, normally I'd get this, but I'm not getting any signal at all from your left kidney. There's nothing there. And the guy said, you're right, it was removed. So it was, and actually two or three of our party had the doctor hold on to them for two or three minutes, and he sort of
gave them a report.
Yes,
very true. And the individual felt that the advice given was very accurate. So it was interesting, it was helpful and useful.
Now, what's different about Tibetan acupuncture compared to Chinese acupuncture?
Well, I can't speak to that directly, but what I can say is that Tibetan medicine is a different system than Chinese medicine. And they use different sets of meridians and different sets of data, but they are each complete systems, and taught both side by side in Tibet at the medical schools. So what I will say that they have in common is they are both making use of herbal medicine, which might be a fun time to say, you know, once I discovered the Chinese herbal medicine for altitude sickness, and we all started taking, many of us started taking it, everyone started feeling a whole lot better a lot sooner. So there's something to be said for herbal medicines that we have not heard of or thought of.
Yeah, I thought about that too, because we were taking Diamox, which is a prescription, but you, several of you had reactions to that.
Right. It's a sulfa drug, and many of us can't take it, and so you couldn't even go there. And I ran into a couple from the UK who were only spending 2 days on the Tibetan Plateau, and then they were leaving again to go on a cruise in China. And I said, oh, how are you guys doing with the altitude? And they said, really, really well. And I said, well, are you taking Diamox? And they said, actually, we took Diamox, and it made us really sick. And we went to one of the local doctors who recommended this over-the-counter medicine, and it's available in the gift store. So then we all went and bought it and started to feel a lot better very quickly.
How amazing is that?
Yeah. The gal that I roomed with actually felt that it reduced the sense of water on the knee, which she experiences every time she travels. So she was pretty excited to be able to have something that might help her on any given time when she's experiencing the differences in altitude that, you know, that cause the body to go into an adjustment factor.
Well, we all want to know, Maureen, are you going to do a Tibetan trip next year?
I think I will. And, of course, it will include someone as wonderful as Gary Wins, who is a remarkable group leader and teacher and a great traveling companion. This man has such a love of the Tibetan people and of discovery and of what it's like to experience new cultures. He has such a great respect for the different ways of people experiencing life on planet Earth. You know, one of the things that we were fortunate to do was go into people's homes and spend time with individual families and perhaps have tea with them or to explore with them what they do or how they live their life. And that's when you begin to realize how dramatically different this part of the world could be compared to our modern life in the West.
We even made a hike quite a ways off the road to spend an hour with some nomads, didn't we? That was pretty remarkable.
Yes.
You know, the way nomads gain their wealth, of course, is with their herds, their flocks of goats and whatever.
Yes.
And just as we were leaving this nomadic camp after visiting a couple of the tents and meeting with the kids and, you know, sharing some gifts like Western jeans and bowls and different kind of hygiene products that we gave out as gifts, the oldest son returned with the herd of goats. And he showed us how he uses a sling. Now, that was pretty neat.
So he used the slingshot to bring the herd back in.
Well, he uses the sling to keep predators off of the goats. And he showed us, and this thing, I promise, it cracked like a sonic boom when this kid could let it go. He could hurl a quarter-pound rock over 100 yards.
That's amazing, isn't it?
And our Tibetan guide, whose name was Punzala, he was just a fantastic heart and a great soul and a great teacher. He knew everything. He could do the sling as well, and that thing popped like a bullwhip.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing. And to think that there are families that live this way of life and have lived this way of life for centuries after centuries after centuries, and that there's no need or desire to move beyond that, to do anything more than perpetuate the way of life that they have known in this beautiful, beautiful area of the world where the mountains meet the sky, where the fields can be as beautiful and green as can be, and that can be extremely cold, just extremely cold. I mean, we were there in the spring, and it was very, very cold. The Tibetan people have a wind-rubbed look, I think.
You remember when we were up, I think it was at least 14,000 feet, we were going through a pass, and there was a glacier, and we actually walked down to almost the face of this glacier and sat down on the ground, and we meditated for about 15 minutes in the sun. It was awesome.
Yes, it was. And interestingly, the Tibetan children followed us. Now, it was our intention to kind of get away from the... In some of the various places where tour buses stop, the local Tibetans have learned, you know, to set up a little shop selling water or ride on a donkey or a goat or a yak or take a picture with a Tibetan like that. And it's a form of enterprise, which is quite interesting. And yet it was our desire as a group to move close to the glacier and to have a quiet, contemplative moment and to do a meditation. And yet the children continued to follow us. And so after we did our meditation, then we taught them a little song. And they sang it with us. And that was really, really charming.
Yeah, it was so amazing how this people were, they were so ready and willing to dance, to sing, to participate in chants and songs, whether it was an orphanage or whether it was the nunnery or whether it was just people along the side of the road. Generally, I found them to be a very happy people, a very fulfilled people, even though by our standards they live in quite a state of poverty.
Yes, yes. It's amazing what a little love will do, a heart filled with love. You know, it's healthy even in spite of difficult living conditions.
Yes, it is. Well, my guest has been Maureen St. Germain once again, and we have just returned from 19 days in Nepal and Tibet and the rooftop of the world where her company, Transformational Enterprises, has led a successful trip to Tibet, and there will be much knowledge and much change that comes from this year's trip, her first of many to come, I believe. I appreciate
you
so much.
Yes, you can still, if you want to travel with us, you can still come with us to Egypt in the fall.
That's right.
Here.
Don't forget, go to X Squared Radio, click on the 14 Magic Days banner, and join us in Egypt in October, right?
That's correct.
You don't want to miss that. Maureen's been there several times. She knows the ins and outs, so you're going to get to do things and see places that you won't get to see with any other company. I guarantee it. Well, Maureen, thanks for being on the program.
It's been my pleasure, and thank you for joining us on this journey. It was remarkable to have someone with your talents and insights and passion. It was just a treat.
I don't know. Maybe we'd have still been stuck in Shigar with a broken down bus, but other than that, I don't know what I contributed, but I sure had a great time, and I'm definitely in the hat for the next one.
Very good. Thank you for having me.
I'll talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye. My friends, Earth Explorers, you're going to hear much out of this. Wait till you see the video that we did from this. When the documentary's done, it'll be for sale at xsquaredradio.com. And we will be back next week, same time, 6 p.m. Eastern time, and I will play my exit. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.